Hi, everybody. It's Liz Nord, and you're listening to the No Film School podcast. Filming in war zones has been a badge of honor among photojournalists and documentarians for as long as it's been possible. But it's also dangerous and potentially even deadly, as the documentary community was reminded of in recent years with the tragic loss of Sundance-winning Restrepo director Tim Hetherington, who was killed while covering the Libyan civil war. And yet, intrepid storytellers keep on entering these situations. So how does one prepare for such a production, both practically and emotionally? My two guests today can help answer these questions from recent personal experiences. Nathan Fitch embedded with the U.S. military in Afghanistan for his film Island Soldier, and Daniel McCabe filmed amidst various factions of the Congolese civil war for 6 years for his documentary This is Congo. I spoke with the directors before their film screened at America's largest documentary festival, DocNYC, and I think you'll really enjoy hearing about their experiences and the advice they have about what gear makes sense to bring into a conflict and how to shoot while you're literally being shot at. By the way, it may sound at times like we're recording in a war zone, but that's in fact downtown Brooklyn construction. Apologies in advance for the occasional background drilling. Hello. Welcome to the No Film School podcast. Can you guys start just by introducing yourselves and telling us the names of your films?
Hi, my name's Daniel McCabe. I'm the director of This is Congo.
My name's Nathan Fitch. I'm the director of Island Soldier.
So first of all, you've done it a million times, but can you give us kind of the log line? Tell us just what your film is about and where it was shot.
My film's about four characters' lives amongst war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and it was shot in the Congo.
Island Soldier explores the high enlistment rates of people from Micronesia in the U.S. military. And it was filmed in Micronesia, and I filmed in Afghanistan, and then military bases around the U.S.
And so how did each of you get involved in these projects in the first place?
Well, this is my first film. Prior to this, I was a photojournalist. So I was based in East Africa working as a freelance photojournalist. And in 2008, I had gone in to cover a conflict, what was commonly known as the CNDP war in the Congo, and that was my first time there, and I kind of got bit by the bug and just decided to focus specifically there.
What was it about the Congo that attracted you?
It was like Narnia on acid. It's like Congo is this other place where different than other African conflicts that I've worked in, this has a different flavor. I mean, the country's so balkanized in terms of its military and these armed groups, and it's so vast, and you have all these resources that are fueling it that I think kind of initially drew me in, but in reality, the story is so much bigger than the resources. While that's kind of what's perpetuating it, it's a real confusing, wild ride that I just felt compelled to focus more on, and it's undercovered.
I came to the subject of Island Soldier after I finished undergrad. I'd gotten kind of burned out with art school, and so I decided I wanted to like have an experience living outside of the U.S. So I joined the Peace Corps and lived in Micronesia for 2 years. And my job there was historic preservation, so I was essentially going around doing photography and video to sort of. The islands have had a lot of colonial waves of people, and they've lost a lot of their traditional culture. So there's a push to kind of preserve the last remaining kind of parts of that. And then while I was there, I was also working with young people on the island who were interested in art. And I started to see one of my friends was recruited and left the island and went on a tour and came back about a year later. And there was just this incredible change in him. And I guess it planted a seed, and that was a while ago, but I started thinking, like, what is it like to go from one of the most remote, peaceful, beautiful islands to war? And then what is it like to come back? And that was kind of the seed of the project.
And you both did something that could be considered being embedded with various factions that you covered. But what does that sort of concept of embedded mean in relation to your project? Like, how did you consider yourself embedded with people involved in these conflicts?
Well, initially, I'd set out with kind of a shotgun spray scenario where I was looking at different armed groups, and among them was the National Army, which is really tough, almost impossible to get like real access to, aside from just some kind of pre-made, pre-packaged interview or whatever. And just by chance, I had gotten the opportunity to I guess what we'll call embed. I had gotten in close with a group of soldiers, and then we put in the work to get the clearances, which is really difficult. And I guess for me, it's in my mind, it wasn't like the traditional embed that that many photographer colleagues of mine do around the world. It's a little more loose in Congo, so I guess you can call it an embed. For me, it was like just hanging out with a bunch of guys that had this pocket I could kind of sit in and observe from.
So we'll get to Nathan in a sec, but in Nathan's case, he was sort of with one group of soldiers, and he was with the American Army. In your case, you actually managed to portray the conflict from several different perspectives. So how did you get in with different groups? Like, did they know that you had also filmed with the other groups?
Yeah, I see where you're going. You know, Congo's a special place where there's like hundreds of armed groups and dozens of front lines and all these different micro conflicts that are happening. So journalists hover around and these different armed groups often want the platform. So it's not as hard as it might seem to go and meet with armed groups and to get their, to get them to stand up on their soapboxes. But what was really difficult was to get, embedded with them in a real way where they could relax and you could start really being a part of their real life. And that didn't really happen until I started working with the National Army. And the way I got in with them was, coincidentally, I was arrested by the main character in my film.
Wow.
Yeah. So once we were brought back to this kind of a makeshift outpost, we were waiting for a commanding officer to come and hand us down our fate, as it were, because we had been crossing from one armed group's controlled, an FDLR-controlled area, which is this armed group, and traveling too late at night. Long story short, the commanding officer comes in, happens to be an old childhood friend of my field producer. So then we hit it off, and the rest kind of fell into place.
Unbelievable. It's like, with docs, it's always stranger than fiction.
Totally.
And Nathan, you had the more what we might consider traditional embed. You went through a formal process. So tell us about that.
I would say in my film, there was the embedding in a foreign culture and living abroad in this island and becoming close with the people, so that when I showed up with a camera, during a funeral, the people would accept me. During these like difficult moments, I had the access built in. I learned the language. I really had that access sort of because I had spent time there. For my film, I really felt like it was vital. I already had captured kind of the island. The islands are just lush and green and beautiful, and I really felt like I needed to juxtapose that with the footage from a war zone. So I went through the process of requesting an embed with the U.S. Army, and I wrote about it for No Film School, but if you are doing that with a film, you have to sign a production association agreement. So I did that and then went over and spent about 3 weeks on a forward operating base outside of Kandahar, essentially going out with a group of guys looking for IEDs every day. It was interesting. I knew Tim Hetherington. He had shared an office in a photographer's studio that I used to work in the Brooklyn Navy Yards. And I think going into my embed, I had like Restrepo in my head, and I thought it was going to be like a tiny base on the side of a mountain and firefights every day. And by the time I got to Afghanistan in 2000, I guess the end of 2013, the war had just shifted. Those bases were closed, and the soldiers weren't really even getting out of their vehicles when I got there because someone had lost their legs a couple weeks earlier by stepping on a landmine. So,
I mean, that's where the stuff gets really real. We'll get more into that. But stepping back, for any doc, you really, there's all sorts of preparation that has to happen. But in this case, like when shooting in a war zone, it seems like there might be some special prep sort of emotionally. And physically, you can't bring everything. So could you speak to both of those things? One is, how do you prepare yourself, kind of gird yourself to get into a potentially crazy situation? And two is, what do you actually bring when you can't bring a whole production truck or whatever?
Yeah, you know, I think I kind of had an advantage by the time in my film where you start to see the fruits of that kind of embedding and access on the front lines. It's a few years into my chasing front lines and working with these armed groups. So in terms of mental preparation, there was no prep needed. I was almost, it was almost counterproductive, where I was just so thirsty for that access that was impossible, that by the time it actually happened, there wasn't even a hesitation or question, perhaps, or I mean, fortunately, not to my own, you know, fault or demise. But in terms of equipment, you know, I shot on a Canon 5D with a glide cam, just a couple of lenses, packed the batteries that I needed, water. That's pretty much it. I mean, it really becomes about the weight you're carrying, because we'd be out maybe 10, 20 miles from any kind of real base or anything like that. So, and these guys that I was with, they'll go days and days without eating or drinking water. So it was... That prep for me was more about it. And then over the years I was working, and then over the, it was probably maybe 7 or 8 months of real conflict coverage, you know, I tweaked my kit. I initially started going out and bringing more lenses, and then, like, you're using them less, or you figure out different, you know, different ways of using less gear. So for me it was just about figuring out how to get the weight down, because this stuff's heavy.
And what about physical protection, like a bulletproof vest, or did you have anything like
that? Yeah, I didn't have any body armor or any of that. I should have, in hindsight, I probably would, although because of the distances we were covering and because of the unit I was with, I didn't really want that. It kind of created a barrier had I done that, because all the men I'm with don't have body armor, and because of the cultural barrier, I guess is the easy way of me putting it. You know, I don't need to put on body armor and then get shot by the guys I'm with, so they can take my body armor. So those kinds of factors went into my head. But again, it's, for me, it was about the weight. You know, body armor had, what, 30 pounds or something? Helmet, another 10 or 15 pounds. And that was, I needed that to carry water. So
in terms of being psychologically ready, I think for me, It was such a long shot to get the embed. When I first approached the military, they kind of, they didn't blow me off, but they just didn't get back to me. And then I showed up and showed them a trailer, and they got interested in the story. But I had this frank conversation. They're like, usually we'd blow someone like you off because you don't have, we're not confident that you're going to like finish this thing. You're just like a dude making a movie. So it like didn't get real until I like bought my ticket and was packing, and a friend called me, and his friend's girlfriend had just been kidnapped in Kabul. This was like 2 days before I flew to Kabul, and it just, you know, I feel like in my head there's like the possibility of getting blown up and like losing a leg, and that would be horrible, but it would be quick, and you'd know the damage. But like being kidnapped, like this woman was grabbed and like marched into the desert. I mean, just the psychological sort of terror of that, I can't kind of imagine. So it got real, but it was too late. I already bought my ticket. So, I mean, I had to carry everything, and I had to have body armor. And I ended up taking a really kind of dinky tripod because I just couldn't carry like a big one. I took like a monopod. I took some lenses, and ultimately, because I was mostly in the vehicles, that was fine. It was pretty difficult. I ended up shooting out the windows a lot, and I had a pretty simple kit. I was shooting on the 70 at that point. I took some like Zeiss prime lenses, and yeah.
I have to say, it's amazing that you guys shot on the 5D and 7D because the films both look gorgeous. You know, I think now, you know, camera tech has advanced. We, you know, film school got our start sort of on the back of the DSLR revolution. And, you know, all that stuff still holds up. All that gear still holds up.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're all, you know, when you're talking gear, they're just tools, you know. So I think what we're really talking about is how do you make these newer, smaller, maybe cruder tools have that cinematic feel. That's what we're used to, these larger cameras or these film cameras. And I think it's just about, you know, it's the components of it, you know, and playing to the camera strong suits where, you know, while these tiny DSLRs can record this beautiful video, they're horrible in terms of stabilization. So you have to start really thinking about that, whether it's throwing it on sticks or a monopod, or I use a glide cam for a lot of stuff. And then if you're off either one of those, it becomes an issue, or that shakiness will, at least from my perspective, potentially take your viewer out of that reality you're trying to create. But cameras are getting even smaller now, you know?
Right.
People are making movies with GoPros, and now I'm shooting with a Sony A7, so that's even tinier,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I would say in some ways for me, shooting with a DSLR was kind of an advantage because it's less smaller. Like, some people assumed I was just taking stills, and there was an advantage to, like, not having the big, you know, I've been shooting with the FS7 a lot, and, like, that's, like, a camera you notice and looks professional, and I feel like there were some situations where it was just an advantage to be less conspicuous.
And people seem to be more familiarized with these, like, you know, like you're saying, you're less obtrusive, mm-hmm. you know, so people will act more naturally.
I hear that in a lot of doc situations, not just, you know, such intensive ones. Just, you know, even if you're one-on-one with a subject in their bedroom, maybe you don't want a big shoulder mount and, you know, everything else.
Even here in this room, if we were videotaping this, right. The difference between a giant FS7 or a little A7S, you know.
Yeah, it's for like, sure.
It amounts to sweat. You sweat less.
You were coming at these from two very different places. I mean, Daniel had a whole photojournalistic background, and Nathan, you kind of were walking in like, wow, this is my first situation like this. But either way, I'm wondering, Daniel, you might not even remember at this point, like, did it end up feeling more or less sort of intense on the ground than you expected?
In terms of this being my first time,
well,
really.
Like, in terms of shooting in, you know, when we say shooting in a war zone, you know, I'm sure all sorts of images come up in your minds. And here's Nathan, you know, shipping out to Afghanistan after just finding out his friend's girlfriend had been kidnapped. And, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of anxiety. And then, you know, once you're there, did it sort of feel like, oh, this is chiller than I expected? Or it's like, oh, this is actually way scarier than I expected. Like, how did it meet your expectations?
I found it to be much more difficult than I initially anticipated, you know. So this film began as a still story in 2008-09. And just by way of necessity and where I was heading as a storyteller, it transitioned into this film. So for me, the real learning curve was like, how do I shoot video, you know? And, you know, one of the things that's always ringing through my head is I had the great opportunity about a year into starting filming. We had brought my editor on board, Elise Ardell Spiegel, who was a godsend. And I had her, like, I'd send footage back and she'd just rip it apart and whip me and say, you know, like, that's not 30 seconds, that's like 5 seconds. Because in your mind, things are racing so much faster. And so I was fortunate to have this guide to kind of like help me technically and make sure I was getting the materials she needed.
So, like, originally you weren't holding your shots long enough?
Things like that. I mean, I wouldn't blanket statement it with that, but it was, for me, the intimidation and the frustration was localized to using the equipment and transitioning from a photographer to a videographer. So that kind of like took away a lot of the edge. And then also, you know, in a lot of the combat situations, I think for me, just focusing on the work and being able to focus on the frames and, you know, while all this stuff is going on around you, at the end of the day, it's, you have that frame in front of you that can kind of absorb a lot of that that nervous energy or fear or things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I actually, my Island Soldier started off as a photo story. I shot like a photo essay for a magazine in the Pacific that I think is gone now. But I also was learning how to shoot video as, you know, in the process of doing this. And yeah, I mean, I think when I first got over to Afghanistan, I just worked so hard to get that access. I was just like really stoked to be there and like really wanted to be out on patrol and get something. Like you go all the way there, you want something and you don't want anyone to be hurt, but you
want to see some action.
Yeah. And I think, you know, because I already had a relationship with some of the soldiers there, I think the troops were a little more open to me, and I think they were also surprised that I kept on wanting to go on patrol with them, and I think they kind of developed a little bit of respect because they're like, some journalists just come and like want to hang out on the FOB and don't want to like go out and get blown up. I think the Island Soldier was workshopped in the Brooklyn Filmmakers Collective over the last couple of years, and that community has been really helpful, especially coming from more of a still background, just to have like a lot of really thoughtful filmmakers. The way that the group works is we get together once a week and workshop a couple of projects. So I started like workshopping sample scenes, and then had an hour-long cut I made, and then Brian Chang, who came on to edit and produce, is in that group also and saw it and got involved, and that's kind of how the final film got made. So a lot of collaboration. And
we're talking about the emotional lead up and, you know, then being there and kind of just getting your bearings and shooting. But then it comes, you know, it comes down to it. You each had some pretty intense things happen, and some scary things that probably only would happen in a conflict oriented film. So, Dana, you talked a little bit about like, well, you know, you've got the camera to focus on and, you know, you can focus your energy. But still, how do you keep your cool when something's happening, like you're faced with a potential IED or there are, you know, bombs flying overhead and everybody's ducking for cover?
I don't think you keep your cool. It's a strange thing, or at least for me, it's a strange thing where, you know, it's to go out into these places, there's this mixture of, you know, I'm very honest with myself in terms of why I want to do these things. I want to do these things primarily for myself. It's a selfish-based reality that I'm living, and it's this storytelling and these stories that I can kind of bring to the world that that kind of justify that to a degree. So approaching it from that perspective, you know, what for me, you know, you're out there and then you're second guessing yourself. You're like, oh, what did I just get myself into? Maybe I bit off more than I can chew. And more often than not, in the types of combat situations that I was involved in, by the time it's happening, it's far too late to make any kind of second decisions. So that kind of really helped a lot of things along where, you know, when you're in it, then it's at that point, and I've had some experience with conflict over the last decade. So then it's just like, all right, now it's time to work, you know, focus on your frame, just keep your head on a swivel, stay low, don't get killed. And, you know, your body does a good job at helping you out with those things. It's not like you're having or at least depends on the person, I suppose, but all the panic attacks would come like after I got back home, you know, not out there. It was just, you know, I guess adrenaline or good times.
Can you think of any specific examples, times where you were like, oh, shit?
Yeah, I mean, I had a lot of close calls over the months that I was covering, you know. At one point, you know, high velocity rounds knocking cameras out of your hands and a lot of mortar fire, a lot of like getting little pepperings from mortar rounds and then just the people you're brushing up against, you know, I think the more freaky part for me was less the things that I couldn't really predict, like projectiles, but more about the men around me, which are intoxicated and psychopathic criminals. So, I mean, while I was with a group of what I would call my friends, I was in an army of criminals. So that all those things kind of, they all, you know, it's a goulash.
I mean, I would really agree with Daniel's point. I mean, I think for me, when I have a camera, I go into a different space, and I'm not. It's not that I'm not thinking, but I'm just thinking differently, and I'm. It's a weird thing, and it's like hard to describe, but it's kind of empowering in a way because I'm just like thinking about the frame and the composition and like what I'm going to do next. It's kind of like I was really into skateboarding. That was my life for a long time. And what I really liked about skateboarding is you can't think about anything else. You just have to think about the next trick you're going to do and the next obstacle. And I feel like when I'm shooting, especially in an environment like that, you just are thinking so fast and trying to figure out what you're going to do that I don't have time to really think too much. And yeah, I mean, you know, there were scary moments. There were scary moments that weren't in a war zone. I mean, I filmed a funeral back in Micronesia, and you know, the whole island came together for the funeral of the soldier who'd been killed in Afghanistan. And I'd been invited there, but I sort of have the shot. I was like over the casket as it's being lowered, and I don't know. I was accepted, but I didn't want to push too much in this moment of grief. It was an interesting moment of sort of balancing the access that I had, but not wanting to like push too far or violate kind of the trust that I had gained. And so I feel like that's scary in a different way, just knowing your limits and what you can get. And then there were like scary things like rocket attacks on the base, or I think I wrote about it a little bit in the thing, but when I'd go out on patrol, they would give me headphones to listen to the conversation. And when the soldiers were scared and I could hear that in their voice, then I was like, wow, you know, I should be terrified. These guys have been here for like 8 months. They've all been blown up. They all know what's up. So if like today it's scary for them, then I should be scared.
And yet somehow you maintained your cool.
Kind of.
Well, you got it. I really like your point about like it's sometimes those quiet times when you don't have the distractions or you don't have that fear or adrenaline or whatever it is, those moments of grief where you're then questioning your own morality and the morality of what you're doing. And especially when you're among people you care about, then it becomes so much more internalized, and that becomes pretty impactful, I think. Versus what I think the viewers would typically think, like, oh, this is the real scary part. It's like, no, I don't even remember that.
Right. I think that's true also of any doc, is that the audience just could never appreciate how much time you've spent with these people. And it's actually a great segue because, again, related to the specific topic, any of your subjects are, you know, potentially going to be hurt or killed. And so while on one hand you need to become close with them and get, you know, get each other's trust and that kind of thing, on the other hand it seems like you have to have some sort of distance enough to like protect your own heart if these people are in danger, which I don't want to give any spoilers away, but they really are in your projects. So can you talk a little bit about that balance and what it's like to either lose or you know, witness the damage to someone you've been spending time with?
You know, I never really prepared myself for that. And I think it's a really good question because in hindsight, when you're working on projects or in environments or with people and your work kind of crosses that line and you're in their lives and their lives are on the line. So sure, of course, people can get hurt. People could maybe get killed. But I never really, you know, I never thought about that, I guess. And then when things do happen, you know, I think there's a degree of grief and guilt. And I mean, I think it's like anybody would experience, regardless of whether you're making a film or you just know somebody. I mean, I think you'll go through those things, but it becomes a bit more amplified when you're kind of a vulture in their life, so to speak. So that's a difficult emotional juggling act that I don't have any advice. It's tricky.
I think for me, it's like the camera is already to some degree creating like a barrier. Like, you know, you're with this person, but you're not like hanging out and talking. You're like filming them. So I think my approach is, in general, is to try to get emotionally close to subjects, just so that, I mean, the projects I do tend to be about people I'm interested in as people, and in that regard, I think developing some sort of intimacy and relationship is helpful, so that they feel comfortable to talk to you and like let you into their lives. But I do feel that, you know, it becomes hard when it's like you're straddling. It is a relationship between a filmmaker and a subject. But you need to be able to do your job. You need to be able to film. And one of the things that was actually really hard when I started making this film and I went back to Micronesia to shoot for the first time was that people would always try to feed me. And like culturally, you know, you should eat. That's like being polite. But I'm like, no, I'm here with a camera. I'm like filming, but I'm like having this, you know, battle because I know like I'm sort of like not being respectful by just showing up and shooting. But yeah, it's a juggling act for sure.
And, you know, how can you not get personally invested? I mean, it's for these types of films, the whole game is to break down those barriers. And you have to really do it. You can't fake that, you know. And the people on the other side of the lens, they can feel that. It has to be real. If it's not, it'll you'll see it, mm-hmm. and you'll feel it. So, you know, it's just a vulnerability that I think is required in the process.
Right. In order for the audiences to connect with the characters, they're sort of you're the conduit for their connection.
And for us to connect with them, because, you know, it's not as if you know the ending of the film while you're in there filming it. So there's this strange leap of faith that you're kind of in a free fall on. So the only real things you can grab onto are these things, are these connections you can make with these characters. Sometimes they're connections, real connections that you want to establish that trust. Other times there is no trust in that connection, but that itself is the connection. So and it comes across, mm-hmm. you know. I have characters in my film where you can feel that trust and that how that access is created. But then there's other characters in my film where you're like, man, I don't know if I could trust this dude. Well, there you are.
Right. So we talked about, you know, the prep and then embedding in and then being there. But I think similar to what soldiers go through, you then have to come back. And again, this applies to any doc. You immerse yourself in some world and then you come back to your world and there's like a strange disconnect. But I imagine in the conflict-oriented film, especially with something like the Congo, where, as you said, it's so undercovered, people here in your daily life probably don't even have any idea what you saw or went through. So what's the re-immersion process like, coming back after a shoot and getting into the post?
Lots of beer. No. It's tricky, you know. I mean, I think it depends on how long you're out there and what you're doing with those personal relationships that you have to re-identify with when you come home. So it's, you know, especially with friends and family, you almost feed off of what you think they're thinking. So when you come back, sometimes you'll be treated, or I found in certain times I'm being handled with white gloves, which would almost make things a lot worse when I wasn't feeling that way, but then I do begin to feel that way. And, you know, it's an emotional roller coaster. And again, it's like, well, you could have certain degrees of experience with danger or conflict or whatever. You know, it's always personal. So, like, you never know how it's going to feel, you know. You never know what something will do to you until it happens. So, I mean, I feel like I handled it pretty well, but I've got a really strong group of friends and family that were always there to kind of help pick me back up. So,
and then I guess unlike a soldier, you know, I'm just thinking aloud, but in the end, you have this document. You have this documentary to share with the world to sort of experience what you experienced, whereas a soldier doesn't necessarily have that documentation of their experience out there.
I was just going to say, I feel like for Island Soldier, none of the shoots were that long. I don't think I embedded for the length of time that you were over there shooting. I would go for a couple weeks at a time. But I think actually you're talking about like the soldier experience coming back from war. And I think the closest thing I felt to that was coming back after the Peace Corps, after 2 years living like really immersed in another culture. And it was just like totally different way of living. People sort of like prioritize community way over like work and personal kind of ambitions. And I think that I was talking to a veteran a couple days ago, and he was saying that having gone through that experience, that's probably a good way to kind of approach thinking about the veteran experience, because it's such an immersive, intense period. And in some ways, like the film, coming back from the shoots has been great. I mean, come back and like get to work on this film. But coming back from that was a little like depressing and traumatic to come back to America for me.
Well, you know, any change, it's like the other day I have this ring I wear, and I'll take it off in the shower sometimes or whatever. But then when it's not on, you notice it. And then you almost keep pawing it, or you paw where it was, and it's always on your mind. So it's kind of like that. I think maybe it's tricky. I don't know. I mean, I think like anything we do, if you ride the subway every day and then all of a sudden you're riding a bicycle and you're in a different, you know, it's weird. Or
yeah. Yeah, it's true.
But, you know, for me, I was, and as you're saying, it's like you're focused on this project, you know. You're out there making a film. It's to some end. But then I think where it probably from colleagues of mine that I've spoken with, I think where it really starts to get tricky is where you don't have that. So for photographers or soldiers specifically, where you're not really in control of that, I think that's where it's probably a little harder to keep that footing on where you're going to let yourself emotionally kind of slide to.
Sure. Conflict or not. I mean, that's another thing you hear from doc filmmakers a lot. It's like, you know, I've spent 3 years doing this thing and it's become my whole life and my whole identity. And now, like, now who am I? Yeah. Kind of a thing. That's just like a common experience. So finally, you know, we are no film school, and it's all about kind of, we're speaking to other filmmakers, and we always ask about advice. And you guys have a specialized sort of area now. So what advice do you have for anyone who might be considering a conflict-oriented film, or a film that has, where they know they'll end up in some sort of conflict zone at some point?
I have like two bits of advice. In terms of just making films or trying to challenge yourself to tell stories, my advice would be like, run as fast as you can into failure, because if you don't have that, or if I'm speaking from my own personal experience, it's, you need to fail in order to figure out where you're going, in a sense. So I think a lot of people are afraid of failure, but in reality, that's kind of the most important thing in my mind. Like, when things fall apart, that's when you have a great foundation to build upon. In terms of conflict, it's about being smart. I mean, I think a lot of people will go charging into these situations, especially now, and especially in our country, you know, where we're kind of getting real used to conflict on a cultural level. We see it not only overseas, we see it here at home. So being smart about it, that's it, because I think, and I've seen people in the field where they realize they bit off more than they can chew, and then they become a problem, a danger for everyone else around them. So I think really, really knowing what you want to do before you go and do it is the best advice.
In terms of advice, I mean, I think my film was predicated on a very specific place that I had a relationship with and I had access, and the funding that we have gotten for the film has largely been through grants and funding specifically for Pacific Islands that I, you know, I feel like you can apply for all these huge, you know, grants, but in my experience, like having a very specific story and then finding these smaller organizations has been a much easier way to kind of get moving. And it's been the kind of thing where, you know, started using my own money and then was able to get, you know, a $10,000 grant to do a shoot and sort of like cobbled it together. But I guess I would just say, I would advise filmmakers who are looking for funding to sort of like draw on their life experience and figure out like relationships or like stories that they have some connection to, versus just finding a story that sounds sexy and like buying a plane ticket. I just feel like that's that's not the way I work, and I know some people do work that way, but and yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like, Island Soldier is about war, and some of it does take place in war zones, but it's also about the impacts of America's wars far from America. And I think, you know, sometimes a story isn't on the front line. Sometimes a story is somewhere else where war, the implications of war might be less visible and less obvious, but no less impactful and meaningful. So maybe look for stories that aren't, I don't think it needs to be in a war zone to sort of be a reflection of war, if that's your interest in like the impacts of war, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a great point. And just in terms of practical sort of advice, I think of this because, as Nathan mentioned, he wrote a post for No Film School about preparing for this type of shoot. And Nathan, you had mentioned like there are some organizations that people can reach out to get a little bit of training and just like being smart, having the smarts that Daniel talked about, like street smart in a conflict way. Can you talk a little bit about that more brass tacks type of advice?
I mean, I wrote that in the post as advice. I didn't do it. I I didn't have time to do the training. I had applied for the Risk, I believe, that Sebastian Younger has.
Yeah, I've taken Risk.
You've taken it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's definitely worth taking a Risk course. It's a phenomenal program. It helps save lives.
And what is that?
Risk is a program that that Sebastian Younger had set up with a group of people in the wake of Tim Hetherington's death, and the aim is to train other journalists in the field with the skills to save other journalists' lives. So had that happen, perhaps Tim would still be with us today, but I think these kinds of programs are super helpful, because it's not only does it give you these skills, but it's a traumatic course to take. And it really puts your head in the game, thinking about very real things that can happen in these types of areas.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I got the news that I was embedding, and I had a couple weeks, and so I just scrambled. I read as much as I could online. I reached out to people like you who, were experienced working in combat zones. And, you know, I think that was something I felt bad going into the embed, knowing like I had bought like a tourniquet, like medical kit, but I wasn't really prepared to, you know, if someone next to me had been shot, I wasn't really prepared to help them. And I feel like it would be good to go into those situations knowing how to protect yourself, but also, you know, if you can save someone else's life, like that's a good thing, obviously.
Well, I appreciate both, you know, the candor from each of you. I mean, you do have to learn as you go. So this point of even having conversations like this is that you're able to now share some of what you learned along the way, what you might have done differently. It's very, very valuable. So congratulations on both films. Is there anything else you want to add or you think our listeners should know about?
Don't go to film school.
That's a good one. I think it's the given of this program.
No, I think it's covered everything.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, and I look forward to seeing the progress of the films and what you're up to next.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you're interested in the Risk training we discussed, you can learn more at risktraining.org. That's R-I-S-C training.org. You can also hear lots of other fascinating conversations on the art of filmmaking by finding the No Film School podcast in iTunes. Make sure to subscribe there or on your favorite podcast app so you can catch our Indie Film Weekly news show, which comes out every Thursday morning and fills you in on everything you might have missed when you were busy making films. Also, be sure to visit nofilmschool.com for useful new articles every single day. Meanwhile, stay in touch. You can reach me on Twitter at LizFilm, and we are on Twitter at No Film School. See you on Thursday.